This is Advanced D&D, a podcast on WUKY, hosted by Dan Wu and DeBron Thomas. In this episode, we'll be talking about, well, hey, we went to the movies. Shang-Chi is on the menu, along with plenty of music and a reaction from me, anyways, about that delicious mousse we were talking about last week. That's coming up right here on Advanced D&D on WUKY. Well, Dan, here we are at another week and another, you know, week full of news.
Yeah, you know, is it even news if it's not bad news? We start off with Hurricane Ida. Not only did it hit Louisiana, New Orleans, the Gulf Coast, but ensuing floods have completely inundated the Northeast, including the New York, New Jersey area. I checked in with some of my New York friends. Thankfully, most of them are out of town somewhere else, but some of you have probably seen these incredible videos of just water gushing into the subway system and, you know, streets and interstates in New York and in the Bronx and in different places, just like flooded, like cars floating around. We were very lucky to have as few fatalities as we did. I think the count was around 43. For that whole region. But all these sort of events, you know, it really goes to show that America's infrastructure, we are not prepared for climate disasters. And we're going to continue to have year after year, these, you know, temperatures going to get hotter, temperatures going to get colder, floods are going to be, hurricanes are going to be worse. These wildfires are going to keep growing out of control on the West Coast. And we really have to get with the program, even if we're not working towards mitigating the effects of climate change. We at the very least need to kind of put in the infrastructure and the public safety to help us react faster to these situations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even looking back at earlier this summer, you know, with what was going on in Seattle and the actual buckling of the highways out there. For me as a kid, like I remember kind of coming up right around, you know, 2003, 2004, you know, the conversation of climate change really kind of became big enough to where, you know, I was paying attention to it. And I feel like there have been so many people who have for years tried to, you know, be like, oh, well, this isn't a big thing. This is, you know, it's either it's not real or it's not a big thing. And now like you have, you know, situations like flooding in Texas and in New York and, you know, the buckling of highways in Seattle, and of course, continued wildfires in California. My question is like, when is it going to be a real thing? You know, how much more damage needs to happen before some folks realize this is happening. It's not just coming. It is here.
I think there's a mental disconnect between a lot of these events and climate change. When people talk about climate change, I think it's very easy to think of it as this big nebulous abstraction that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to folks. And then when you have a wildfire, you say, oh, that's a wildfire because it happened because X, Y, and Z. And this hurricane happened because of X, Y, and Z. But if you look at the aggregate science and the trends for the last, you know, few decades, it is very evident that things are accelerating, that things are not only accelerating, but getting worse every time they do happen. So I really do hope that people can start wrapping their minds around it. And not only that, but putting enough public pressure on officials and lawmakers to actually do something about it. Speaking of lawmakers, Texas has basically outlawed abortion for all intents and purposes. They have on the books now after the Supreme Court didn't really actually vote for or against it. They just basically voted to not deal with it or to not really kind of look at it. So in Texas now, you basically cannot get an abortion after 6 weeks. Now, 6 weeks is a really, really early threshold. Most women, most folks getting pregnant do not know that they're even pregnant at 6 weeks. So to get around the legality of making this happen, because this is basically, you know, it countervenes, you know, Roe v. Wade, what it does is, instead of the state punishing somebody for having an abortion or giving an abortion, it has placed that power in the hands of, I don't know, let's call them vigilantes at this point, because the way this law works is that if you, as a regular citizen, not even having to live in Texas, not even being remotely affected by the actions of others, if you know of someone who is attempting to have an abortion in Texas, you can sue them yourself. And if you win, you get all of your fees paid for, plus a $10,000, what's it called, bounty. And you can also sue any nurses, doctors, or, you know, facilities that had a hand in this, not only performing an abortion, but anything that has to do with aiding and abetting an abortion in Texas. It's incredibly wide-reaching. It sounds ridiculous, and the rational part of my mind says, like, how can this actually go through and actually work? Well, here's how this works. If a clinic or a medical provider that performs abortion procedures wants to do it, they're going to be hit with so many lawsuits left and right that even if they knew the verdict would be on their side at the end, which they don't, it's going to basically bankrupt them to fight all of these lawsuits. So none of them want to take that risk. So basically now, for women and people who don't want to carry on their pregnancies for any reason, which is their right, they have to get the hell out of Texas and do it somewhere else. It's an incredible turn of events, and it's very hard to see from the pro-choice side how things may turn around.
It's been really fascinating watching this conversation happen at the same time with the, like, you can't force me to wear a mask, it's my body, my choice, but all of a sudden these things don't match up in the case of women's reproductive health, and in the case for abortions as well. Reading Senate Bill 8 from Texas, it's just really incredible to me how evil it is. Like, I can, for the sake of having a conversation, I can understand if people have a, are against abortions. That's your opinion, and that's fine. I personally am of the belief that people should be able to have their own bodily autonomy in terms of those kinds of things, and that it's really, frankly, none of your business what they do with that. But the part that really just gets me is this whole bounty thing. Fortunately, we've seen that Lyft put out a statement a couple days ago saying that they would pay for the legal fees for anyone who were to get sued under any driver that would be sued under these, this particular law. And they also said that they were going to give $1 million to Planned Parenthood, a show of solidarity, that they feel that no one should feel unsafe in this situation. And man, white supremacy is a whole thing. And just watching this happen the way that it does, knowing every statistic will tell you that the people who are the most at risk are women and trans people of color. It's incredibly frustrating. And I would say to anyone listening right now, if you are upset with this, show up to the ballot box during this next election, because it's going to be crucial moving forward.
Yeah. And the fear, of course, and, we say slippery slope sometimes as a sort of a way to describe something that probably won't happen, that we're stretching a little bit with our logical conclusions. But the slippery slope here is that with the Supreme Court stacked 6-3 conservative, Roe v. Wade is not a foregone sort of, solid, thing that will continue to exist no matter what. In other news, Naomi Osaka, the young tennis phenom, who has been very outspoken and very direct and very honest about her own sort of emotional toll that she's taken with the sport. She recently lost in round three of the US Open, and she gave a press conference and said she's going to step away from tennis for a little bit and not really sure when she'll come back. And it made me realize, and it made me do a little bit of reading about how tennis is very singularly one of the hardest and kind of loneliest sports for athletes. You don't have the team camaraderie that can get you through wins and losses the way you do with team sports. And you don't have the sort of, you know, second place runner up sort of consolation that you do with something like the Olympics or even a race. You either win or you lose. And Naomi Osaka described, you know, the two outcomes of a match is that she's either devastated that she loses or she's relieved that she won. Not excited, not enthusiastic, not, you know, happy that she won, but relieved. And it's, you know, it's taken down a lot of the biggest athletes in the sports. Bjorn Borg from Sweden, who was a superstar in the 1970s, won 11 Grand Slams. After he lost his fourth U.S. Open final in 1981, he literally walked off the court and drove away in his car and never played a big tournament again. Steffi Graf, and he was 25 years old. Steffi Graf quit at age 30. So it's a brutal, brutal sport. I'm happy only for the fact that Naomi Osaka is kind of out front advocating for herself and being very public about how hard all of this stuff is. And I really do hope, you know, I don't know how much the pandemic has to do with it, but the pandemic does feel like a catalyst for showing us all the cracks in our system. And so hopefully, you know, the general public and the sports loving public will have a level of sympathy and empathy for these athletes who are giving us way, way more than just their performances.
So I recently watched the untold story of the Malice in the Palace, which was the, you know, this big fight that happened at the, in Detroit when the Pacers were playing the Pistons, and you know, there was this big brawl that occurred, and it was kind of, everything was kind of put at a catalyst when a dude threw a beer at Ron Artest and he went into the stands and punched the person sitting next to him, who this person openly says like they wish that they had just pushed him out of the way, but literally they threw the beer at him and then moved out of the way for him to watch him go punch someone else. But kind of one of the things through this documentary that it kind of shared was, you know, one of the reasons why Ron Artest like laid on the scorer's table was he was doing a breathing technique that because he was in therapy at the time, and he was trying to calm himself down and release himself from this particular moment. And I really think that a lot of times people forget that athletes are people, that they have the same struggles that we do. Just because they make millions of dollars doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have their own struggles. And, you know, in terms of Naomi Osaka, like I'm so proud of her for owning her own mental health and, you know, prioritizing herself over like everyone else's feelings. It's just really frustrating to watch, you know, her kind of get taken down, you know, for, you know, being, you know, weak or whatever, you know, all of the stereotypical things that you will say. And, you know, what I would say to that is, well, you know, one of the greatest athletes of all time required a step away from the game. So if you're not going to say anything about when Michael Jordan walked away to retire in his prime, don't say anything about Naomi Osaka. Just, you know, like, we as people, like, this is a really difficult time in general for everyone. So just because you think that you know the way that someone is dealing with something, you really don't.
Yeah, and the very dark side of our hero and celebrity worship in this country is coupled with our sense of entitlement that they belong to us and that they should be doing whatever it is we say they should be doing, whether it's, you know, go play your sport and don't complain, or when the chicks spoke out politically, the whole shut up and sing kind of thing. They're still human beings and they get to express themselves and conduct themselves in whatever way they like. Speaking of celebrities, China has been on a tear lately to remind the Western world and the U.S. that they are indeed an authoritarian regime. They have done a couple of things recently. They have banned effeminate men from television because they think particularly the influence of J-pop and K-pop, which, you know, a lot of these groups have young men that are very sort of androgynous. You know, the style and aesthetic of today is very sort of effeminate or androgynous and not adhering to what the Chinese government thinks is real masculinity for men. So they don't, they're out and out banning it because they have that power. And they are also limiting online gaming for school-aged children to 3 hours a week. And I think if we did that here in the United States, boy, oh boy, that would be something. I, you know, as a parent, I am for philosophically the idea of like, let's maybe have a little less screen time. But I think, you know, we in America, we definitely very much chafe against when things like this come from the top. And, you know, and part of that, honestly, that mentality explains how we have pushed back so hard against mask mandates and vaccine mandates and anything the man tells us what to do. But there's got to be some sort of balance, right, between that level of authoritarianism and or just like, oh, it's America. You get to do whatever the hell you want.
I totally agree with you. And I appreciate you bringing it back around to the mask mandates and vaccine mandates because the parallels are there. I'm with you. Like, I think that, you know, there should be a limit on screen time, but I don't think that it should be coming from the government to tell you how long your kids are supposed to, you know, to play with things, especially given how much screen time they would have, not counting, you know, virtual learning, but, you know, at school, like there are lots of things that happen that way too. But yeah, I don't know. I really hope that it's like, if you have a feeling about this and you're upset about the mask mandate, well, you know, maybe take a look in the mirror. Well, moving into pop culture, Anthony Hamilton has recently released a single from his upcoming album, Love is the New Black. It is a quite a bop, and I look forward to hearing the rest of this album. His last album came out in 2016, and it was good, you know, but I would love some more Anthony Hamilton in my life, especially some things I hadn't heard before. Well, moving into this week in Anderson .Paak, in case you had not heard, Leave the Door Open has officially reached platinum status, which means it has sold over 100 million copies of the single. So, you know, props off to Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak. And then, you know, there was this whole thing that happened on the internet. I was trying to avoid spoilers for this upcoming Marvel movie, sitting in the movie theater. And at the end of the song, the movie, here's this song. And I'm like, I know who this is. And so Anderson .Paak has also released a new single that is part of the Shang-Chi soundtrack. It is called Fire in the Sky. And it very much is a bop and definitely can set a mood for whatever it is you're hoping to have happen, you know, at that particular time.
Yeah, that whole situation felt like it was almost tailor-made for us in this podcast. The fact that an Anderson .Paak song rounded out the movie that I was probably the most excited for this year, which we will talk about, but we're gonna leave room for it because there's a lot to unpack.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into TV and movies. One of the things that I had been watching this week and kind of on your recommendation was Reservation Dogs. It's a show on FX and Hulu produced by Taika Waititi. And the humor very much is Taika Waititi. There are several bits and, you know, things, ways in which dialogue is written to let you know that it is Taika Waititi. But it's basically, you know, a show about these kids who are living on a reservation and, you know, just kind of deals with their trials and tribulations of what they're going through and how they're trying to get out of their situation. So it's an entertaining show. I've only seen the first two episodes, but I definitely would recommend it. What else has been going on with you this week?
Yeah, speaking of Reservation Dogs, the other sort of co-producer of the show is Sterling Harjo, who I would give the bulk of the lion's share of the credit for creating a show that just feels really, really real, and in a way that tackles the things that you think it's going to tackle, but in a very roundabout way. You really, really, really can tell with shows and movies when the creators and the writers and the creative teams behind the visions are the people, are the same kind of people who are being presented on screen, that it's not one group of people writing for a different group of people. The level of authenticity is there, is amazing. And what I really loved about it was, and I think I've said this about the Black Lady sketch show on HBO, is that there are so many things in here that are not for me. They are for Indigenous and Native folks. And I love that. I love that, that they don't have to try to speak to absolutely everyone. Speaking of show that is definitely not for everyone, I binged a Netflix show called Brand New Cherry Flavor. It is off the wall bonkers. Ostensibly, it is about a young filmmaker played by Rosa Salazar who comes to LA to pursue her dream. She gets hooked up with this very typically sleazy producer. It takes place in the early 90s. He screws her over and she proceeds to put a curse on him with the help of a witch played with just deadpan brilliance by Catherine Keener. You may remember Catherine Keener as the one who will send you to the sunken place. But yeah, the show is very much, you know, coming off the backs of David Lynch and Cronenberg, a lot of body horror, a lot of just gross stuff. Like the actors, bless them, must have spent most of their shoot just covered in corn syrup and, you know, weird applications all over their faces and bodies. But a very, also just a very fun show, but not for the squeamish, for sure.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about what we came here to talk about today. So just for everyone who is listening, spoiler alert for Shang-Chi. We're going to talk about the movie. We're going to drop some spoilers. So if you have not seen the movie, you should pause, go watch it and come back, or you can skip ahead. But just warning you, this is your spoiler warning.
Yeah.
So Dan, what you might not know is that Dan had asked me to come to see this movie with him. I wanted to. I was very upset that it was not available streaming, but given pandemic life, you know, I took a risk, and I'm really glad that I did. And I had a good time at the movie theaters. It was nice to be in a movie theater again. But Shang-Chi, what were your takeaways?
Wow. Where do I even start? Honestly, my biggest takeaway, I was really pleasantly surprised by how much of this movie was in Mandarin Chinese and subtitled. This is not much of a spoiler, but it starts off kind of giving you the backstory about the Ten Rings organization. And so there's a voiceover, and then it gives you, you know, some shots of like ancient China and all the stuff happening. But the voiceover is in Mandarin. And I was thinking, if this movie were made 20 years ago, or even honestly 4 years ago, that voiceover would have been in English, like 100%. But it was in Mandarin, it was subtitled. I could always also tell as a native Mandarin speaker that whoever wrote this dialogue was writing in Chinese. It was not a script that was written in English and then translated into Chinese. It was written in a very sort of Chinese way. That said, overall, I thought the movie was a really great origin story of a honestly fairly obscure character that only ran from 1973 to 1983 before being relaunched in 2020, just last year, by Gene Yang and an all-Asian creative team, kind of brought him back to life. And his beginning in the comic book world was not auspicious or not... let's just say not great, because he was the son of Fu Manchu. Like the whole thing was rooted in very much, you know, racist stereotypes. So this reinvention, relaunch of Shang-Chi was great. It's nice to see an origin story that doesn't involve somebody's parents being gunned down in an alley or being bitten by a radioactive spider. It was a brand new story that most of us didn't know. The casting was just 100% perfect. Tony Leung playing the dad, just a Hong Kong legend. Michelle Yeoh playing Shang-Chi's auntie, got to show off some of her moves. Just all in all, really, really great movie. And again, man, does representation matter. I saw in line in front of me this little family of five with fairly young kids of all like Asian folks. I don't know if they were Chinese or not, but just to be able to see yourself on screen, to hear your native tongue on screen and see your sort of culture represented in very sensitive ways. It was just all around, can't recommend it enough.
I think that it's very apparent, similar to what happened with Black Panther, that Marvel was very intentional about making sure that this film was written by, people who are Asian, written by and for, that particular community. And everyone else, we get to come in and we get to appreciate it as well. But this was a movie that was very much written for an audience that hadn't had this kind of opportunity before. And I was, it was really wonderful to see, because I remember what Black Panther did for myself, like just seeing a superhero who looked like me that was not a stereotype. And I know that, especially in the comics, like when it comes to Asian characters, they have not had the fair share of positive representation that's not rooted in stereotype somehow. But speaking to the film, I really appreciated, and this was something that I said to you after the movie that I was corrected about. So this film does take place after Avengers Endgame. So I thought that it took place in between the blips, but it takes place after Avengers Endgame. I'm also a sucker for any movie that shows off the Bay Area in any way. So already kind of got me there in my feels, but just the music was beautiful. And I wanted to take a minute to talk about this, because I know this is like a stereotypical thing, but as somebody who has been working with a dance company for the last several years, I appreciated the choreography so much, because it was like everything was like a dance. And it was, it just watching, like, between, the fight between Shang-Chi's parents, and all of the fights later, there was so much beauty and grace. And like, you could tell that everything was detailed to the most minute thing.
Yeah. One of my peeves with American action movies has always been that if there's a shot of somebody getting punched in the face, it requires four or five cuts in the edit. Whereas in classic Chinese and Hong Kong martial arts movies, they just pull it out to a wide shot and let these two amazing performers go at it for minutes at a time, showing you exactly what that choreography looks like. Absolutely brilliant. Great fight scene on the bus. Really inventive in terms of, I love the way Shang-Chi was moving in and out of windows and different spots. Great fight on the scaffold with a whole bunch of people coming up and down different levels, very video game-like, which I love. I heard a podcast recently, somebody made a really good point that this is one of the few action movies where the way somebody fights is also character development, that it's not just a couple of people beating each other up, but the way Win Wu, Tony Leung's character, fought and the way his future wife fought were two very different styles. And as you said, their initial meeting and fight scene was almost like a mating ritual. It was like a dance. And then later on, echoed by Shang-Chi being trained by his aunt, played by Michelle Yeoh, we got that sense again. You had a lot of flourishes, leaves swirling around, reminded me of movies like House of Flying Daggers or Hero. Just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. A lot of great little subtle casting if you are a fan of Asian and Asian American cinema. Tai Chin of Lucky Grandma fame played Awkwafina's grandmother. The landlord from Kung Fu Hustle played one of the old senior training mentors from the village. I'm forgetting the guy's name now, but there are a bunch of little cameos like that. Ronnie Chen is great, comedian last probably seen in Crazy Rich Asians. And of course, inevitable, you know, MCU cameo from Benedict Wong as Wong. I could just see that character more and more. He's so fun. So yeah, no complaints about this movie. Actually, my only small complaint would be that it kind of ends the way most MCU movies end, in just like loud, bombastic, overly large action sequence that doesn't make it's just hard to watch after you've seen these gorgeous one-on-one fight scenes with this great choreography, and then it just kind of descends into people flying around in the sky with giant dragon creatures and whatnot. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to follow. It reminds me of all the other MCU movies where it's just like a bunch of heroes in the sky fighting off giant invasions of things. So it would have been nice if they could get away from that, but maybe they're contractually obligated to have giant sky fights at the end of every movie.
It's like J.J. Abrams having to have a lens flare in all of his movies. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And I was trying very hard to avoid spoilers. And one of the things that popped up on my phone that I immediately swatted away was some review that was like, Marvel can't stop telling, you know, its larger story to, you know, long enough to get a, you know, to just do the plot of a movie. And I don't really feel like the larger overarching Marvel plot really had any weight on this story. I felt like where, you know, like we got little like sneaks of it, like between the fight between Wong and Abomination, and then, you know, seeing that like Abomination, Wong was going to take Abomination back to the raft, and that they were actually like training each other. And it was like a whole, like, you explained this to me, you said that, like a WWE type of situation where they were partnering. And then of course the post-credit scene with you know, Captain Marvel and Bruce Banner, you know, looking at where the rings came from. I thought that, you know, this was a very good origin story, especially if you, you know, like Black Panther. It's one of those things where you didn't have to have a lot of prior knowledge of what was going on in the MCU to walk in and enjoy this film. And I appreciated that both Black Panther and Shang-Chi had that, you know, given that people could just go and feel the representation without having to feel weighted by the larger story. But I still don't think that the larger story really had much of a negative impact on the movie. I thought that the way that they did it was really good.
Yeah, I agree with that. There were definitely times where something would be mentioned about either Avengers or kind of the world as it was, and I was almost shocked, like, wait, oh yeah, we're still in the MCU. It felt like just a movie from a whole different sort of universe. And, you know, to me, like, if you came into this cold as a non-Marvel, you know, person, you know, you might just be slightly confused about that whole scene, like, who are these other people and holograms and what are they talking about, you know, but that's 2 minutes out of a 2-hour film. So I think it stands alone really well. And I think it's, you know, in some ways hard to come by, because to some degree, I think we're all going to suffer from a little bit of bloat and fatigue of being, you know, literally bombarded now with 3 movies a year, 3 to 4 Disney Plus shows a year. I'm sure there are more casual fans out there that are just like, I can't keep up with all the stuff, or I'm not interested in all the stuff. So to be able to walk in and see a movie like Shang-Chi and not having to have the emotional and time commitment that it requires to be, you know, complete dorks like us, you can still actually get something out of it. It's nice.
And, you know, one other honorable mention, Trevor, played by the legendary Ben Kingsley, was a very nice touch.
Yeah. I've realized my favorite characters very often in movies are characters like K2 from, you know, the Star Wars movies, or Babu Frick, or Korg, just these sort of side characters, because they don't have to carry any emotional or narrative weight. They just get to be funny and weird. And Trevor is so, so good. Probably my favorite part about Iron Man 3, honestly, is his arc. Ben Kingsley starting off playing against his, you know, regal Shakespearean diction, classic actor thing, to be just kind of like, he's this poor sap trying to get through, trying to survive on the only skill that he has is as a middling thespian. So good. Great lines. I really want him. I think we talked about this, wanting Weasel to be just like in every DCU film. I want Ben Kingsley's Trevor to be just a little cameo. Like, instead of Stan Lee, we just have Trevor now, kind of moving through the MCU like Forrest Gump. He just happens to be in the background of every major incident, and just a little line of commentary like, oh, what are we doing here? Would be great. Can't get enough of Ben Kingsley.
And I also, well, also honorable shout out to Morris, who was definitely my favorite character as the little creature from Tao Lao. Yeah, Morris is awesome. And I'm excited to see where the 10 rings are going to go moving forward. The end credit tag said that they are going to return. You know, could it be, obviously, they'll probably be in the sequel, but, you know, could they show up in a Disney Plus series? Who knows? The possibilities are endless. Well, let's move on to food. I have to just go ahead and start off by saying that last week, you know, Dan will usually talk about food. And if he's feeling really good about it, I feel like he'll share how it is made. But I remember when you were talking about this blackberry mousse.
Lemon cheesecake mousse.
The lemon cheesecake mousse. You didn't say, you know, drop any hints on like how to have it. And it was one of those things where I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And then I saw you were going to be serving it this week, so I couldn't stay away. And let me just go ahead and tell the world that it was absolutely delicious. And if I could hug you right now for it, I would.
Yeah, that's a great dish, and it's really easy, and honestly, there's no secret to it. I found the recipe on the internets, and it doesn't take very long. It's no baking. You just have to follow the directions and don't screw around like I always do. Follow the directions, and it's such an easy dish. Speaking of which, so DeBron's talking about that I had set up as a food truck, along with my buddy Chris Kane from Daughters Southern, a great Lexington food truck. We set up kind of each did some menu items. I every time I travel elsewhere and every time I read about, particularly about Asia, I really do wish that America, but also particularly Lexington, Kentucky, could have a better food scene or food truck scene / street food scene. Food trucks and food stalls and food vendors are the, you know, easiest point of entry for food entrepreneurs to get into. You don't have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to build out a building and doing all the stuff. You know, so many people can do it. And when you take away barriers to entry in anything, you get to improve that particular, you know, industry or community. So I do wish between laws or maybe low interest loans from the city or small business grants, things like that, I wish we could really encourage and nurture more of a street food scene. And, you know, from a purely selfish point of view, I just want to eat good, cheap food more often.
I am a big fan of street food, as you know. I grew up in the Bay Area, and there's a very big culture around that. And I wish Lexington had more of, and I feel like a couple years ago, it was definitely on the like cusp of becoming a very large thing, but also like, I don't know, like, I feel like the people who usually like who would benefit from a street, you know, from having a food truck are not usually those who are like invited to the big events that had happened pre-pandemic. So I hope that as we are kind of like coming back to whatever the new normal is, I really hope that a lot more underserved people have the opportunity to show out, because all it takes, like you said, is just like give people an opportunity to come to the food, and the rest will handle itself.
Absolutely right.
Well, let us move into, pandemic advice, as our pandemic advice from every episode is.
The pandemic advice for this week and the next coming weeks is very simple. Please get vaccinated. If you're not going to get vaccinated, wear a mask and stay 6 feet away from other people. Continue to wash your hands and be vigilant because this virus is still out there. This pandemic is still happening. It has begun to mutate, and the only way we're going to get through this is by taking care of those around us and ourselves. So again, please get vaccinated, and if you're not getting vaccinated, wear a mask and continue to stay 6 feet away from other people and wash your hands.
Okay, it's always weird hearing myself talk like that and then talking right after myself. It's odd. But anyways, what is your do you have any extra pandemic advice for the people this week, Dan?
Yeah, as we're moving into fall 2021, that's just like, I'm going to think about what I just said. Fall 2021, we're a year and a half into this thing, and it's this constant roller coaster of just up and down, opening, closing, masking, no masking, get out there, stay home, come back. And so a lot of the events that got canceled last summer, last fall, last year, some of them got pushed to the spring, and then very quickly we're like, nope, that's not happening. And I think a lot of people, at least here locally, have put a lot of hope in fall 2021. September of this year, as of a couple months ago, looked jam-packed. Every weekend there was a big public event, Roots and Heritage Festival, Pride, Comic-Con, all this kind of stuff. And they are being canceled one after the other. And in a weird way, like, A, I'm disappointed that events are getting canceled because I know how hard it is to put these events on, how much time and effort and money are involved, and how disappointing and just, you know, financially wrecking sometimes they can be for organizations and companies. But on the other hand, the events that aren't being canceled, like Comic-Con, for example, as of the taping of the show, is supposed to happen in a week, in like 5 days. And there's a part of me that's like, how is that still happening? Something like that is an indoor event that in the best of times is jam-packed. And people have, I forgot what it's called, people have this thing called like, you know, convention lung or something like that, where you leave these kind of things and you're just going to go home with a cold because you're just around too many people. So add a global pandemic and the coronavirus on top of that, it's just not a good scene. And I know it's disappointing, you know, for organizers and for attendees to have to miss it. Comic-Con is my favorite thing to go to every year. And it's, you know, coming on a year and a half, 2 years since I've been to one. And I'm very disappointed. But at the same time, I don't know, there's no responsible way to do some of this stuff. So as a just a regular person who's either attending or not attending these events, if you don't get to attend your favorite event, have some grace, have some patience. They will come back. It's just not a great time to do it now. And if you do attend some of these events, be patient and be respectful about whatever precautions that they're taking, whatever, you know, things that may not be ideal, service that might be a little slow. And this definitely applies to your favorite small businesses and restaurants in particular. Just be patient, be cool. And as we have said over and over again, don't be a dick.
Yep. Co-sign everything you just said. And one thought that came to my mind as well is with how going back to Shang-Chi for just a moment, it is being apparently is pretty had a pretty successful opening weekend. And that is causing some studios to not delay films that they are planned to release, but just be smart about it. And, you know, do the very best you can to keep yourself safe. And if you don't feel comfortable going somewhere, don't feel pressured into it just because everyone else is doing it. Do what you feel is best for yourself. And with that, it brings this episode to a close. This has been episode 28 of Advanced D&D, a podcast on WUKY, hosted by Dan Wu and DeBron Thomas. We will hopefully get a chance to talk soon, and we'll, you know, see you on the other side.
Take care, y'all.